Hello, folks. Welcome to LRIS's first Thursday podcast for July 2015. This is Will Aitchison, and over the course of the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, never know how long these things are going to last, I will bring you up to speed on what's been happening over the course of the last 30 days or so in public safety labor relations. Normally, when I do these podcasts, I'll take you on a bit of a tour around the country. I'll talk about a case that's happening in California or in Florida or wherever it is. But I want to start today in the nation's capital. And I want to talk about the big deal in the last few days in the United States Supreme Court and elsewhere. And by big deal, at least in the context of labor relations, I'm not talking about the gay marriage case. To be sure, there will be some labor relations fallout from the gay marriage case. You can anticipate that we are going to see some changes in the way, for example, the parental leave and spousal leave aspects of the Family and Medical Leave Act are going to be administered. I think that's pretty predictable. In the area of employee benefits and health care plans, I think the notion of who a spouse is going to have to change in some places. But overall, there's not a lot of labor relations connotations that we see so far in the gay marriage case. No, I'm actually recording this on June 30, and I want to talk about something that happened today after the Supreme Court went out of session. What it did was to announce that it's going to hear the case of Fredericks versus California Teachers Association. What is Fredericks versus California Teachers Association? This is the case that the National Right to Work Foundation, this is another one of those Koch brothers funded outfits, has been teeing up for some time to challenge head on the constitutionality of fair share payments. And let me just back up a little bit for those of you who are not completely on top of the issue of fair share. This all goes back to when public sector collective bargaining laws began to be very popular. And the first wave of them were passed in this country in the 1960s, and then a whole bunch of them were passed in the early 1970s. Many of those laws, most of those laws, had to deal with a particular issue arising out of union dues. What do you do with someone who doesn't want to be a member of a union? We know because this is the public sector, you can't force them to join the union. If it's the public sector, that means it's government, which means the Bill of Rights applies to government's actions, and you can never force somebody to join an organization if you are a government. We know, therefore, that employees can't be forced to join a union in the public sector. We also know that employees who have what are called bona fide religious objections to paying union dues can be excused from paying union dues and can be required to pay an equivalent amount into a non-religious charity mutually agreeable to the union and the employee. But what about everybody else? What about people who simply don't want to join a union? They're too cheap to want to join a union, or they have philosophical beliefs against joining a union, or maybe they don't like this particular union, whatever it might be. And the compromise that most collective bargaining statutes reach was to say that those people who don't have religious objections and who don't want to join a union, they can be required to pay their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the union contract, pay that to the union. And that's become known over the years as some people call it an agency shop. Some people just refer to it by fair share. And typically, these fair share dues, they're sometimes called fair share assessments, typically what happens is they end up being a little bit less than regular union dues because unions do things that are unrelated to negotiating and administering of collective bargaining agreements. Most public safety unions, for example, have an annual Christmas party or a picnic. Well, that's not related to the collective bargaining process. So the union's costs associated with those non-collective bargaining events can't be assessed to fair share members. And typically, you see fair share assessments in public safety, police, fire, corrections, and the like. You see those assessments as being around 90-95% of union dues. And I'll talk in a little bit later on in this podcast about what rights fair share members have. But for right now, I just want to focus on this notion that you can assess a fair share dues to non-union members under most state collective bargaining laws. Well, early on that was challenged, and it was challenged on free speech grounds. And the argument was, look, by paying money to an organization, by forcing the government to pay money to an organization, you are doing the equivalent of forcing me to join that organization, and that violates my free speech rights. And that issue, the constitutionality of a fair share assessment, went up to the United States Supreme Court in 1977 in a case called Abood, A-B-O-O-D, if you care about the spelling of these things. And the Supreme Court ruled in Abood that fair share was constitutional. And as a result, we have fair share systems all over the country. And typically in public safety, you don't see a lot of people taking advantage of this. You don't see a lot of non-members. You see them a lot more in educational fields. Sometimes you see a pop-up from place to place with nurses. But most police and fire, you don't tend to see too many fair share members, although you do see some from time to time. Well, Abood was 1977, and that's a long time ago. That's almost 40 years ago, and the Supreme Court has considerably changed its complexion in the 38 years since Abood was decided. The court is very much more conservative today, conservative in the sense that it doesn't particularly like labor organizations, much more conservative today than it was. And there are five justices on the Supreme Court, the five members of the so-called conservative or right-wing, I don't know, I hear lots of names associated with them. There's five justices on the Supreme Court who pretty much routinely rule against labor organizations whenever a case comes up to the Supreme Court. I try to keep track of these things, and by my count, and I'm probably counting wrong, there have been 48 decisions involving unions and management since this current Supreme Court has been constituted, and management has won 44 out of 48 of those cases. And that's not an accident, that's an ideology that is at work there. So, back to fair share. I continue to divert myself here, but let me get back onto the fair share issue. In the last 10 years or so, as the conservatives on the Supreme Court have really felt their oats on these labor cases, the Right to Work Foundation out of Virginia has begun trying to convince the court to overturn Abood. It has teed up a number of cases that have gone to the Supreme Court or where the Right to Work Foundation has asked the court to consider the case. Most notably, it convinced the court to take a fair share case last year, a case called Harris versus Quinn out of Illinois. And while the Supreme Court issued a decision in the case, it didn't ultimately tackle head on the issue of constitutionality of fair share. However, with this new case that the Supreme Court accepted for review today, Fredericks versus California Teachers Association, that's precisely what the Supreme Court is going to do. That's the only issue in the case, is the constitutionality of fair share assessments. There's no way to decide this case on a different basis the way there was the Illinois case of Harris versus Quinn. The Supreme Court is going to decide the constitutionality of fair share, and it will do it sometime in the spring of 2016. How's it going to come out? I think we've seen in the last week with all these decisions from the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act and the gay marriage case and the death penalty case, and there's just a bunch of cases that were decided in the last week where a lot of people making predictions predicted incorrectly as to how some of those cases were going to come out and how particular justices would vote. And that tells you that, you know, even for people who watch the court very closely, it's risky to predict how a particular case will come out. That said, reading the individual opinions of the justices on the court on the issue of fair share in the last few years leads me to think that there are four solid votes to overturn Abood. This is a Supreme Court that is kind of conservative by ideology, but it's not conservative in the sense that it is reluctant to make new rules. This has probably been the most activist Supreme Court of our lifetime in terms of overturning precedent and overturning statutes and things like that. I mean, you just see this court do that all the time, where that used to be a rarity for the Supreme Court to do. So this court, these four justices, wouldn't think anything of overturning a 38-year-old precedent and kind of creating a new world in public sector collective bargaining. That would just be a normal day's work. So I think you can count to four. The question is whether you can count to five. And some people who are pretty close court watchers aren't sure the way, of all people, Justice Antonin Scalia is going to vote. Because when there was that oral argument last year on Harris versus Quinn, Justice Scalia actually seemed to have some sympathy for what unions call the free rider problem, the notion that if you don't have fair share, then somebody who's not a member simply gets all the benefits of union membership, the collective bargaining agreement, the duty of fair representation, without having to pay for it. And Justice Scalia seemed to have some sympathy for that. But who knows? And this is one that we're going to have to very, very carefully watch over the course of the next year. If, in fact, they overturn fair share, all this is a direct attack on unions' abilities to finance its operations. Unions are going to have to look for other financial resources apart from fair share assessments. Now, I promised you that I'd talk about a case that just came down involving the rights of fair share members. I'll get back to Washington, D.C. in just a moment, but let's take a short journey over to Michigan for a recent case from the Michigan Court of Appeals that lays out, I think, pretty well what the rights of non-members of a labor organization are. This involves a local union of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and they were in the middle of a decertification measure. Some members of the union, three members of the union, filed a petition with Michigan's Public Employment Relations Commission wanting AFSCME decertified as the exclusive bargaining rep for the bargaining unit. Well, the local of AFSCME, it's local 1583, brought charges against the employees, internal union charges under AFSCME's constitution, and they cited a provision of the constitution that allows sanctions against any activity which assists or is intended to assist a competing organization. And the way AFSCME works these things internally is they have a trial body within AFSCME. So these three members were put on trial, and then eventually what AFSCME calls a judicial panel had to make the decision about what to do with them, and what it did with them was to kick them out of AFSCME. Now, mind you, because it's the public sector, if you are kicked out of a labor organization, it doesn't mean you lose your job. It doesn't have any impact on your job at all. It just affects your union rights. And the big deal that these three members cared about was they wanted the right to vote on contract ratification. And AFSCME said, no, only union members can vote on contract ratification. And so the three members then file a an unfair labor practice complaint against AFSCME with Michigan's Employment Relations Commission, and the case ends up in the Michigan Court of Appeals. It's pretty rare these cases end up in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals issues a decision that, as I mentioned, I think just pretty summarizes the area, the law in this area, very, very well. And what the court ends up saying is a union has the right to draw a distinction between members and non-members in terms of the benefits they enjoy. The union can't distinguish between who it's going to represent or how it exercises its duty of fair representation. It can't pick and choose between members and non-members and say, I'm only going to take grievances on behalf of members. It can't do that. But with respect to internal union issues that are unrelated to the process of negotiating and administering the contract, a union can bar non-members from that, and one of the things the union can bar non-members from doing is voting on a contract. As the court says, and I'm giving you a short quote here, employees within the bargaining unit who are not union members need not be afforded the right to vote on the ratification of a collective bargaining agreement. The only obligation owed non-members by unions is the duty of fair representation. And that duty is not violated by the mere failure of the union to allow non-members to vote on the contract. Well, what else is it that a union doesn't need to allow non-members to do? Doesn't need to allow them to vote in union elections or run for union office or appear at union meetings. And remember, I mentioned that fair share assessments are typically less than union dues because the fair share assessment has to be related to only those union expenses arising out of negotiating and administering the contract. Well, those other things that a union does, the Christmas party, the flowers in the hospital if somebody is injured, a union newspaper, all of those things, they don't have to go to non-members either. So all that is up to the union. The only duty that a union owes to its non-members, as this court says, is the duty of fair representation. All right, back to Washington, D.C., and the other big deal that happened today, June 30th. What a day. I ended up writing a blog post for about an hour today about all of these things. The other big deal is the Department of Labor has finally issued its draft FLSA exemption regulations. Who's exempt under the FLSA? Who is, in the words of Section 213A of the FLSA, who's an executive, professional, or administrative employee? Okay, let's set the stage on this. When the FLSA was enacted, Congress allowed an exemption from the overtime requirements of the FLSA for employees who were, in the words of Section 13A of the FLSA, bona fide executive, administrative, or professional employees. Congress didn't bother to define any of that stuff. Instead, it gave the Department of Labor a broad grant of rulemaking to define who is exempt under the FLSA, under Section 13A. And many, many times, the Supreme Court and lower courts have upheld the Department of Labor's ability to make and change its regulations as to who is exempt. For many years, there has been a two-part test as to who is exempt. Think of them as the salary test and the duties test. And what the salary test is that you have to make a certain amount of money in order to even qualify for this exemption. Unless you're making whatever this threshold is at any one moment in time, unless you're making that amount of money, doesn't matter what your duties are, you're not exempt. You've got to make a salary of that amount. The duties test says, look, if you are salaried, if you pass that first test, you are exempt if you have duties that qualify for one of these three exemptions. The executive exemption, usually higher ranking supervisors are thought to be exempt. The administrative exemption is usually people also way up in the chain of command who are intimately involved, not in supervisory duties, but as high level assistants to who decision makers are who run an organization. And the professional exemption, the duties typically stem from work of a very specific nature that requires a degree from a institution of higher education. So there's these three types of duties that are out there. And the Department of Labor over time has revised both the salary test and the duties test. The last time the Department of Labor did this was in 2004. And it did so with a very odd name to the regulations it was rewriting. It called these regulations the Fair Pay Initiative or the Fair Pay Regulations. Why is that odd? It's odd because those regulations actually stripped any number of people of their ability to collect overtime. It broadened who was defined as an exempt individual under the law. And remember, 2004, this is the Bush administration, Department of Labor, very pro-business. And estimates are, and who knows what's right here, estimates are that anywhere from 6 to 10 million people who formerly got overtime under the FLSA were ineligible after the Fair Pay regulations in 2004. Well, what was the salary threshold set in 2004? It was $455 a week, or the equivalent of $23,660 a year. Those were the people above that level, so people making slightly under $2,000 a month, that the Department of Labor in 2004 said were highly compensated executives. You see why so many people lost their ability to collect overtime under the FLSA. Also, at the same time, the Department of Labor created something we'd never seen before. And it's a highly compensated salary test. And what the Department of Labor said was, if you make more than $100,000 a year, you are subject to a different test on your duties. It's a much more relaxed test, and it's much easier for an employer to claim an exemption if somebody makes more than $100,000 a year. Now, these 2004 thresholds, they weren't indexed to inflation or indexed to anything for that matter. So they're the same numbers that are in effect today. So today, it's you actually see litigation over these things. You see them from, there's a whole lot of litigation on the East Coast involving these dollar stores, dollar general stores and the like, where their managers, who may do 95% of their day, may spend 95% of their day ringing up sales and pushing a broom and doing non-exempt work, but they spend 5% of their time doing things like interviewing applicants and supervising people. These managers who make $2,000 a month don't get overtime. And they work 60, 70 hours a week. Yeah. And you see court decisions from federal courts of appeals upholding that, deferring to the Department of Labor on what the scope of these rules are. Well, one of the things that the Obama administration, Department of Labor, has wanted to do is change those regulations. As a pro-management, as the Bush Department of Labor is, the Obama Department of Labor is pro-employee. And it has long been on the list of things to do for the Department of Labor to change the regulations. And what they did today was finally issue the draft regulations. And they'll be finalized through the rulemaking process before the end of the year. And usually the final rules aren't very far off of the draft rules. You can expect that what I'm about to describe is what we're going to see when all is said and done. So what's the Department of Labor doing? It's really doing four things that I think are really important with these draft regulations. First of all, that salary threshold of $23,660 a year, the $455 a month, that's going to be increased a little bit. A little bit as in more than doubled. The salary threshold will go up to $970 a week in 2016, or the equivalent $50,440 a year. And the Department of Labor is not at all embarrassed about such an increase, more than doubling. What the Department of Labor is saying is, look, what we are doing is we're setting this thing rationally. We are pegging this salary threshold at 40% of the 40th percentile of weekly earnings for full-time salaried employees. 40th percentile. That's not too high, says the Department of Labor. So that's the first thing they're doing. So they're going to increase the salary threshold. And, you know, for most unionized police, fire, corrections, that's not a big deal. But I'll tell you what, you get into non-unionized public safety environments, particularly in the South, we're going to see some employees who are going to be eligible for overtime who weren't eligible for it today with that change in the salary threshold. Secondly, the Department of Labor is saying we're going to keep that highly compensated employee, the higher threshold, only we're going to increase it from $100,000 to $122,148 a year. How do you pick $122,148 as a number? And the Department of Labor's answer is, we picked it because that's the 90th percentile of wages for full-time salaried workers. So again, we're not pulling this number out of the hat, says the DOL. What's the third thing the Department of Labor is doing? The Department of Labor is saying, we're going to index these two numbers. No longer are we going to have a salary threshold that just lays there dormant and doesn't increase with changes in income. And so what the Department of Labor is proposing to do is that it will index both of those salary thresholds, the regular one and the highly compensated employee one, index it according to the wages earned by salaried employees in this country. The fourth thing the Department of Labor is doing is warning us. It's not, these aren't changes that are going to happen, but if I were an employer, I'd want to be getting really up to speed on this fourth area. The Department of Labor is saying, look, you know what we're not doing? We're not going to change the duties test right now. But we heard a lot of comments on it, an awful lot of comments on it. And we are going to consider, we're going to take comments from all of you as to whether we should be changing the duties test. Oh, and by the way, what about employees who are using electronic devices at home? That's the Department of Labor's charming phrase, electronic devices. It doesn't mean a microwave. It means smartphones or laptops or, to the extent anybody is still using a pager, those sorts of things. What about those people who are using those devices at home, says the Department of Labor? Well, let me just read you three sentences from the Department of Labor. And this is one of these areas where you got to say, employers, watch out and make sure your voice is heard on this. Same thing to employees. Here's the Department of Labor. During its outreach to stakeholders, you can't tell this is a governmental body writing this, can you? The department heard questions and concerns related to the use of electronic devices by white-collar workers who may be newly entitled to overtime pay as a result of this rulemaking. Because this concern involves compensation for hours worked by overtime-protected employees, it's beyond the scope of this rulemaking. However, the department understands the importance of this concern and will publish a request for information in the near future seeking information from stakeholders on the use of electronic devices by overtime protected employees outside of scheduled work hours. We're going to do that in August 2015. So get ready. Cell phone use at home, we're about to see the Department of Labor weigh in on that issue as to when that's compensable and when it's not compensable. And one other thing you can predict, looking at that topic of cell phone use at home, one of the things the Department of Labor is going to have to do, I think, is take a look at the what's called the de minimis rule under the FLSA. This is the rule that small amounts of time are not compensable under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Department of Labor has long had a kind of a, it's not really a rule, but it's an opinion, that if an employee works the greater part of 15 minutes, meaning 8 minutes or longer, the time is not de minimis and they're entitled to compensation. However, since the Department of Labor has expressed that view, we've seen some courts say, look, there's a variety of factors going into what makes some time de minimis or not de minimis. And with the increase in technology as to how we can track time to the minute, with that increase in technology, time below 8 minutes may well be compensable. There are some court decisions saying 2 or 3 minutes is compensable work under the FLSA. Well, what about the electronic devices at home? What about, and I'll just pick somebody at random, a police public information officer who gets a call at home saying, hey, there's been this event that has gone down, a gang shooting. What's our comment? And the PIO gets off the phone within 2 minutes or 3 minutes after giving a precinct captain advice on to what to say and what not to say. Is that 3 minutes compensable under the FLSA? I think because the Department of Labor is going to be looking at the issue of the compensability of using these devices at all, I think it's going to have to take a look at the de minimis rule. And it's going to be interesting to see how that one comes out. While I'm talking about the FLSA, I do want to pick up on a case that came out of California in the last month. It's a small case. It's 28 police officers in the city of Sanger, California. It's a small case, but it involves a couple of things about overtime calculations that come up from time, one in particular, that comes up from time to time that, yeah, I find employers sometimes have a difficult time complying with the law in this area. So what's this about? This is about how you calculate the overtime rate. And under the FLSA, the overtime rate is time and a half, a creature the FLSA calls the regular rate of pay. The FLSA and the Department of Labor, in turn, have defined the regular rate of pay as including all remuneration for employment. If you take a look at Section 7E of the FLSA, you'll see a whole bunch of, I think there's 8 or 9, I've forgotten the number now, exclusions from the regular rate of pay. There's lots of detail about this, but as much detail as there might be in the FLSA or the Department of Labor's rules, there's always inventiveness in the collective bargaining process where a new form of pay is created, and the question is it included in the regular rate of pay? Well, I'll tell you what my rule of thumb is whenever I hear that question asked. My rule of thumb is expect, not 100% of the time, but expect that if whatever this form of pay is shows up on the employee's W-2 as income, expect that it's going to be included in the regular rate of pay calculations. Now, there's some exclusions for that. Holiday premium pay is not included. Reimbursement for expenses is not included. But you can generally expect it shows up on the W-2. It should be included in the regular rate and thus should be included in the overtime rate. So what's the case in Sanger about? It's about two forms of compensation. The first is cashback for employees who opt out of the employer's health care coverage. Now, Sanger has a plan, like you see in many places, where employees who have a spouse or significant other who can cover them on their health care coverage can receive a cash payment if they opt out of the city's health care plan. So they'll rely on the spouse or significant other's plan and won't participate in the city's plan. City gets a good deal because the experience rate for health care goes down because these people are no longer there, at least theoretically goes down. Actuaries will tell you it may not actually be the case. And the employee gets a good deal because they get a cash payment, whatever it might be, $100, $250, you know, whatever the it might be. Well, in Sanger, these 28 police officers who were suing were saying, look, the city should be including cash back in the regular rate of pay, in the overtime calculations. And the court agreed with the employees. The court said that, look, cash back has to be included because it's a form of compensation to employees. The city's argument was, look, these payments aren't made as, and they're quoting from a portion of the FLSA here, they're not made as compensation for hours of employment, therefore they don't need to be included. And the court says that's not true. Under the city's health benefits reimbursement program, the way it works, the court says, the city contributes a fixed sum of money towards medical benefits, and employees have the option to receive part of this in their paycheck. Thus, and now I'm quoting from the court's opinion, the benefit is tied to their compensation for hours of employment because the employee must be working to qualify for the health benefits and any reimbursement. Furthermore, the payments are subject to state and federal withholding taxes, medical taxes, Medicare taxes, garnishment, which indicates the cash payments are remuneration for work performed. Remember that rule of thumb I gave you? If it shows up in the W-2, it's likely to be included in the regular rate of pay. There's the court saying pretty much the same thing. Now, the city had something it was relying on from the Department of Labor. Department of Labor used to issue private opinion letters, private in the sense that they only dealt with one party, but they got publicized. And there was a private opinion letter issued in 2003. And the Department of Labor said, and it pretty much made all this stuff up because it's not in the FLSA, the department said that cashback payments through a cafeteria plan need not be included in the overtime rate if no more than 20% of the employer's contribution is paid out in cash, and the cash is paid under circumstances that are consistent with the plan's primary purpose of providing benefits. And the city of Sanger is saying, hey, that's like us. We don't have 20% of our people participating, and that's the purpose of this plan. And the court was unconvinced. The court said, look, that opinion letter, to the extent we think anything of these opinion letters, and by the way, courts typically don't think much of these DOL opinion letters, and they're thinking less of them as time goes by. The court says that opinion letter was written in response to a case where there was detailed information about the health care plan, and that wasn't the case here. It's undisputed, says the court, that 20%, the 20% threshold is met, but none of the other necessary facts regarding the program have been presented. Now, what was the other form of pay that the city was not including in the regular rate and the overtime rate? It was merit pay increases. And the city's argument was one of those exclusions from the overtime rate under the FLSA, one of those exclusions is for discretionary bonuses. And merit pay, argues the city, since we have the ability to either give it to somebody or don't give it to somebody, it's discretionary, and therefore we don't have to include it in the regular rate of pay. Not so fast, said the court. The court says, look, if it's something to be a discretionary bonus, it can't be called for by the collective bargaining agreement. And your collective bargaining agreement, city, also specifically says when merit pay is going to be given. It has a clause in the contract, or it's known in Sanger and MOU, that specifies how merit pay is going to be received. And the court says it's just the fact that you have a collective bargaining agreement in and of itself indicates to me that this is not a discretionary bonus. And also, the court says, look, you just didn't give us enough details, much like the cashback option on healthcare. You didn't tell us who's got discretion, whether the city manager really has discretion, whether grievances are going to be filed about this, whether there's a past practice where this has become an expectation. You didn't give us information on the timing and the frequency of these merit pay adjustments. You just didn't give us enough detail. And if you're going to claim an exemption under the FLSA, employer, it's your burden of proof, and you didn't meet that burden of proof. I'll tell you, without even considering that criticism, at least to my eye, the fact that merit pay is listed in the collective bargaining agreement, the MOU, as a form of compensation, that ends the issue. I think it has to be included in the regular rate for overtime purposes. Well, have I numbed your minds enough talking about the FLSA and, in particular, how you calculate the overtime rate under the FLSA? Just be thankful I didn't get into the formula you have to use to calculate the regular rate of pay. Well, let's unnumb your minds by talking about a Facebook case. This is one involving firefighters in the state of Maryland. I'm going to give you a pretty detailed recitation of what was posted here, because what and how it was posted, because I think it's important. I think there's some lessons here that apply in a lot of these Facebook cases. But before I get into the facts, can we all agree we shouldn't have any more Facebook cases? I am so tired of seeing these case reports involving public safety officers who forfeit their jobs to the pleasure of posting something on Facebook, whether it's firefighters, as it is in this case, or police officers, or deputy sheriffs, or corrections officers, every month. You know, I try to read all the published opinions in the country about police and fire labor relations, and every month I'm seeing case after case involving social media posts. And I mean, really, we have to do a better job of getting the message out there that there are no enhanced free speech rights to post something on Facebook or Instagram or send out a tweet, whatever it might be. It's just not a place where you can say whatever it is you want to say. And so learned Kevin Bucher, a battalion chief in what's known as the Emergency Services Bureau of Howard County, Maryland. And this is the bureau there, the Emergency Services Bureau, is part of the Department of Fire and Rescue Services. Bucher has a Facebook account, and he's got Facebook friends that involve members of the department and other public safety agencies. He has set his Facebook settings, his privacy settings, to friends. Only friends can see the activity. As you'll see in a moment, that makes no difference whatsoever. There's no such thing as a private Facebook post. What happened to Bucher will illustrate that. He didn't say in his Facebook profile that he worked for the department. However, he did post photographs of himself in a uniform participating in the fire department's honor guard at a convention. And he tagged himself in one of those photos. And he also had photos of himself teaching EMT classes, including one of him in front of a cake that read, "Thank you, Chief Bucher." So in other words, he wasn't kind of actively publishing the fact that he was a department employee, but you could very easily figure out that's what he was. This all happens on January 20th of 2010. He's working at the department, and he's watching TV, and He's watching news coverage of a gun control debate. You know where this is going to go, right? He then posts to Facebook while he's on duty. He posts this, and I'm quoting, "My aide had an outstanding idea. Let's all kill someone with a liberal. Then maybe we can get them outlawed too. Think of the satisfaction of beating a liberal to death with another liberal. It's almost poetic." One of the people who read this was a volunteer firefighter with the department. His name was Mark Gritzmacher. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, so I'll call him Gritzmacher. He wrote a comment on Bucher's Facebook wall, and his comment was, "But was it an assault liberal? Got to pick a fat one. Those are the high-capacity ones. Oh, pick a black one. Those are more scary. Had to perfect on a cool idea." Bucher, the chief, then likes Gritzmacher's comment and posted the following statement, LMFAO, too cool, Mark Gritzmacher. So, what happens? A battalion chief takes a screenshot of Bucher's Facebook post and sends it to an assistant chief who brings it to the fire chief. As I said, there's no such thing as a private Facebook post. An investigation then starts. The assistant chief asks Bucher to take a look at his posts and take down whatever he feels might not be consistent with social media policy. Let me know when this is done. Bucher responds by removing the original post, even though he tells the assistant chief that his comments had been misunderstood, and then Bucher posts something else. He says, and I'm quoting, "To prevent future butthurt and comply with a directive from my supervisor, a recent post meant entirely in jest has been deleted. So has the complaining party. If I offend you, feel free to delete me or converse with me. I'm not scared or ashamed of my opinions or political leaning or religion. I'm happy to discuss any of them with you. If you're not man enough to do so, let me know so I can delete you. That is all. Semper Fi. Carry on." Would that it were that Bucher was done, but he wasn't. He then did another post, and this is the last of them. And this one, and I'll just quote part of it, was, "Howard County, Maryland, and the federal government are all liberal Democrats at this point in time. Free speech only applies to the liberals, and then only if it is in line with the liberal socialist agenda. All it took was one liberal to complain, sad day, to lose the First Amendment rights I fought to ensure, unlike the wide majority of government I serve." End quote. The county then fires Bucher after doing its investigation. And Gritzmacher, the volunteer, is let go as well. I'm not sure what you call firing a volunteer, but that's what happened to him. And did so for violating its social media policy, and in Bucher's case, added an insubordination charge. Bucher and Gritzmacher both file a free speech lawsuit in federal court, and the court ends up deciding both of them on the same day with pretty lengthy opinions. And Bucher loses, and Gritzmacher wins. Or Gritzmacher at least doesn't get thrown out of court. The court allows his case to go to court. So what's the distinction? Why does Bucher lose? The court says, first of all, this is speech about gun control. Gun control is an issue of public importance, so this is potentially protected by the First Amendment. It doesn't really matter to me that Bucher used some rough words and made some statements that, you know, seem pretty threatening. That doesn't really matter to me because the speech under the First Amendment is robust and at times is not the sort of speech you'd see at a bridge tournament, or maybe it would be. I've played in bridge tournaments. Maybe that's a bad analogy. But the court says, look, all that means is it's potentially protected by the First Amendment. Now we have to get into a balancing test, and we balance Bucher's interest in free speech on one hand against, on the other side, the department's interest in keeping discipline within the department and the department's public image. And the court says, department wins. The court says this. The position of battalion chief is the most critical leadership position in the organization because battalion chiefs manage the day-to-day operations in the field, all emergency services, and direct the day-to-day enforcement of policies and procedures. Now, here's a quote from the court. The content and form of the January 20 Facebook post arguably are controversial, divisive, and prejudicial. And because these potentially offensive messages came from an individual high up in the department's chain of command, the department didn't have to wait to see if the controversy affected the discipline, mutual respect, or trust among the employees Bucher supervised before addressing it. It was reasonable, says the court, based on Bucher's post, for the department to think that those posts would negatively impact the public's perception of the department and interfere with the ability to protect public safety. And then the court tacks on, even if we didn't reach this conclusion, what Bucher did when he took down the post, made the subsequent comments, that was just simply flat out insubordination. And insubordination isn't protected by the First Amendment. So why does Gritzmacher live to fight another day? It's not because he's a volunteer. That status doesn't really matter. The court says the reason is that, and I'm quoting here again, the evidence of potentially adverse effects on the fire department, which the department is basing its termination on, while those are pertinent to Bucher, they're meaningless with respect to a volunteer. And in fact, all of the internal correspondence of the department shows that what it was really concerned about was you had a battalion chief making these posts. And so it allows Gritzmacher's case to go to trial. And that last message is another really important one here too. And that is, it's nothing that courts will ever say, hey, there's a line in the sand. But it is very clear that the higher up you are in the chain of command, the more that is going to be expected from you in terms of your off-duty behavior, including your off-duty speech, including your off-duty social media speech. And the court comes back time and time again here with respect to Bucher, saying, a battalion chief was doing that. That is something an employer cannot tolerate. I want to end this podcast with a discussion of a case out of Illinois involving the Weingarten rule. And in fact, this is an overlap case between Weingarten and Miranda. I've got to say, Weingarten cases, Weingarten is the right to representation in a disciplinary interview. Weingarten cases have been exploding all over the country in the last, I don't know, 2-3 years. It's amazing. This is a rule that had, for whatever reason, lain fairly dormant in terms of litigation. You just didn't see many Weingarten cases out there, and now you see them all the time. And I don't know if what's going on is employees are kind of pushing the envelope on when they demand representation, whether they're more aware of their rights, whether employers are making more decisions to deny employees the right to representation. I'm not sure what it is that's going on, or maybe some combination of all that, but whatever it is, it sure is bringing a lot of Weingarten cases into the jurisprudence. And I have some advice to employers on these Weingarten cases that I give. I give this whenever I do seminars for employers. My question is, why not let the employee have a union rep in whatever meeting this is. I get that sometimes a union rep may be disruptive to a meeting, or the mere presence of the union rep might in some fashion impair what it is the employer is trying to convey. But most of the time, a union rep actually helps the employer. I've seen it hundreds of times in my career, where the union rep will listen to whatever it is the employer is doing, say it's a performance evaluation or an oral reprimand or something like that, where there might not be clear Weingarten rights. The union rep will listen to what the employer is saying to the employee, and then afterwards will take the employee aside and say, you know what? You got to clean your act up. They're right. And if you continue down the road that you are on, your career may be in jeopardy. And I can't tell you how many times I have seen employees take that sort of message to heart, where they might not have taken the encounter with the employer to heart had the union rep not been there. Okay, that's all gratuitous advice. I guess this whole podcast is gratuitous advice now that I think about it. What's going on in this Illinois case? And this comes out of the Cook County Sheriff's Office, and a probationary correctional officer named Gerardo Martinez, and he's working in the jail. And an inmate files a complaint saying that he was beaten by gang members, and Martinez essentially watched, failed to provide him with any protection, and then later failed to make sure that he got any medical attention. These sorts of complaints are investigated in the sheriff's office in Cook County by what's known as the Office of Professional Reviews. Two OPR investigators pick up Martinez at his house and drive him to a Dunkin' Donuts for coffee. Interesting way to conduct an investigation, but that's what they do. They ask Martinez if he knows why they were there. And Martinez said that, I lost my weapon a while back. I'm guessing you're coming to ask about my lost weapon. And they said, no. In fact, we're conducting an investigation into collusion between officers and inmates. And particularly, Martinez, we think you may have been colluding with an inmate named Thomas Prater, and that had some impact on this inmate who was beaten by gang members. And here's the way things devolve after that. Martinez asks, do I need union representation? And the investigators say, we can't tell you whether or not you need union representation, but you're not in trouble. They then asked Martinez whether he wanted to help them out in making an arrest and giving up names of people who were involved in this beating incident. And Martinez said, would helping you jeopardize my career? And the investigators say no. By the way, I got to interject something right there. I know that investigators do that from time to time. Employers, you need to understand that when investigators say that, you're going to be bound by it. And in this fact situation that I see right here, I'm not sure these investigators knew how culpable Martinez might be before making statements like, you're not going to be in trouble. And that would later bind the employer. So it's at a training point right there. Okay, let's get back to where we are. The investigators eventually tell Martinez that they're going to follow up with him on questions, and they eventually sit down with him. And when they sit down with him, they give him a document that is entitled Advice of Rights. And what is this document? It's Miranda warnings. They warn Martinez of his rights to remain silent and a lawyer, and culminate with a waiver of Martinez's Miranda rights. All right, another training point right there. How do you go from your career is not in any jeopardy to giving Miranda warnings, which means you suspect somebody of potential criminal culpability? Something is off here. At any rate, they give him the Miranda warnings. Martinez signs the document and then goes through the interview. And following the investigation, OPR, the Office of Professional Responsibility, recommends that Martinez be fired, and he is fired. Now, I'm sure there are other appeals of the termination that aren't referenced in the opinion that I'm about to talk about. The one I'm about to talk about is an unfair labor practice complaint filed by Martinez's union saying, hey, you violated our Weingarten rights. You violated by conducting this interview after he basically raised the issue of the right to representation, you deprived him of his rights under Weingarten. And this goes to the general counsel of the Illinois Labor Board, and the general counsel sides with the union. And here's the important thing that the general counsel says. The court says, the Miranda warnings raised ambiguity concerning the purpose and effect of the investigation, notwithstanding the investigator's contrary assertions. In other words, Miranda warnings can be reasonably said to automatically trigger Weingarten rights, the right to representation. Now, last year, there was a case out of Pennsylvania where a court of appeals in Pennsylvania held that the giving of Garrity warnings automatically triggered Weingarten rights. Now we're seeing the same thing with respect to Miranda warnings. The general counsel goes on, and it's a fairly long opinion. I'm not going to quote much of it, just another couple of lines, but I think this is pretty important. The general counsel goes on to say, Martinez made a legitimate request for representation when he asked the investigators whether he needed a union rep to be present. In other words, that question, do I need a union rep, that is the equivalent of a request for representation. The general counsel goes on, the labor board has held that the request for representation doesn't have to be perfect. It need only put the employer on notice that the employee desires the assistance of a union representative. And that was triggered here. So this case is, I think, another illustration of that general rule of thumb I started off this section on, that if you have an employee who is asking about representation, if I were an employer, I'd err on the side of saying less, or saying yes, rather than saying no. Okay, that's it for this month's First Thursday podcast. There's a lot more that happened. We're going to be putting it out in our monthly newsletter, Public Safety Labor News. And also do check into our blog. We've got a blog on our webpage, and even beyond that, we have a Facebook page. It's called LRIS Online. That links to articles about the blog, and you'll find more posted, for example, on the Department of Labor's new regulations and various other things that I talked about today on the blog. And with that, everybody, have a great July, and we will see you in August. This is Will Aitchison signing off.